Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term medical plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term medical plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hi, this is Marion Bartoli.
I'm Mats Wilander.
This is Mary Carrillo.
I'm Stan Wawrinka.
I'm Leighton Hewitt.
I'm Andy Murray.
This is Yannick Noah, and you're listening to the Tennis Podcast.
Hi, folks. Welcome to the Tennis Podcast. It's not relived. It's not an oral history. It's not Chris Evert week anymore, unfortunately, although I did very much enjoy Chris Evert week. It's a tennis podcast with actual sort of tennis-based news and talking points in it, which is a very exciting alien prospect. Don't adjust your whatever device you're listening to us on. This is reality. We're going to be talking about the prospect of actual live official sanctioned tennis at some point in the not too distant future. Myself, Catherine Whittaker, David Law is in the house.
Hello.
I know you're not used to doing it this way around, David, but usually you say something a bit more than...
Oh, do I?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. All right then. I'll say that, it's a bit of a turn up, isn't it? Did you think we were done for the year? When we were about 6 weeks ago.
Yeah, 6 weeks ago. Yeah, I've obviously been adjusting my expectations and thoughts and hopes, etc., sort of at every turn along the way. But oh yeah, absolutely. There was a long time when I was pretty certain that we were done for the year. What about you, Matt?
Absolutely, yes. Me too. Suddenly the future is a thing again. And and we're talking about it rather than the past.
I miss the past. I just come to really enjoy the past.
Yeah, the past is a very safe, certain ground, and suddenly all the uncertainty and rumour is back and we're not quite sure where we're heading again.
Don't worry, we've still got 14 shows worth of the past guaranteed. I mean, from Wimbledon.
As things stand at the moment, and barring cataclysmic style events, obviously, which we've come to expect in life, we are going to be recording 5 Grand Slams worth of daily podcasts in the year 2020, which makes me want, you know, all these conspiracy theories about 5G and stuff. Was the coronavirus some sort of David Law manufactured event in order to find a way for us to produce more podcasts in the year 2020?
David has the biggest grin on his face right now.
It's definitely the silver lining that I can find. I mean, we're doing 5 slams worth. Yeah, we are. And that's the plan.
We should probably explain why. Let's cut to the chase of the news, because we've actually got live, actual tennis news to hit you with.
Yeah. Today, well, actually, it was more yesterday, wasn't it? Because the US Open had promised...
it's been kind of, I mean, it's been a not brilliantly kept secret, right? It was leaked to the New York Times. It's been all but confirmed for a few days, right?
Yeah, it was clearly coming that the decision had been made. And frankly, even if you go back to late last week, there were all the plans being talked about by the New York Times, and John Wertheim has been writing the story as well for Sports Illustrated. And then we did a conference call with Feliciano Lopez with a dozen of the British journalists, because this is, of course, Fever-Tree Championships week, it should have been, at the Queen's Club, where Lopez won both singles and doubles titles last year. So he was talking to them a little bit about that. But he also really gave chapter and verse about the player meeting that they had last week, the ATP, a Zoom call. Now, we've all suddenly discovered what Zoom is over the last 3 months, this video conferencing
slash
technology.
Over the last 3 days for David Law.
Yeah, I've done a lot of these. But on this particular ATP player meeting one, they had 400 players on, and this was the USTA and the tours telling the players what the plan was to try to make the US Open playable.
This is on the ATP side only, right?
Yes.
On the men's side only, yeah.
And it turns out none of Novak Djokovic, Rafael Nadal or Roger Federer were on this call. But anyway, they had 400 people on it. And Lopez gave us chapter and verse on this media conference about what was said and the lengths that they were going to go to, and also that he was assured, he was absolutely sure that it was going to go ahead. The US Open is going to happen, he said. He also said it should happen, in my view. It's time for tennis to get rolling, because bear in mind, he's not just a tennis player these days, he's a tournament director. He is going to be fronting one of the events that will take place in the remaining months of the tennis calendar. That's Madrid. He's the tournament director there. But he had a pretty stark message for the players in that call that we are going to have to accept less prize money. We're going to have to get used to that. We're going to have to basically stop being so precious, is what he was saying, and understand, be realistic about the year we're in, the climate we're in, the situation we're in. And if we want a going concern of a sport to play for the future, we need to do something about it, because otherwise the whole system is under threat. The ATP, the WTA, the slams even. And that's what this is all about, primarily for the United States Tennis Association. They do not have pandemic insurance to cover them the way that Wimbledon do. And they also have, according to the New York Times, $70 million at stake from ESPN alone with the staging of this tournament. So if it didn't go ahead, they would not be getting that $70 million. So, as you say, we then came into this week, and yesterday we were told by Andrew Cuomo, the governor of New York, that the event was going to go ahead. He was going to pass it. He was comfortable that it was safe, and he's basically said sports are back in business in New York, which has done a fantastic job by all accounts of suppressing the virus in recent weeks to get to this point. It seemed frankly absurd maybe 6 weeks ago that this could have been the case. Well, I think we'd all pretty much written off the US Open as a possibility. And anyway, yesterday he said it's coming, and I think that caught the United States Tennis Association on the hop, to be honest. I don't think they were expecting him to reveal that news yesterday. So they quickly rushed out a statement saying, yes, the event is going to go ahead. We're delighted about it, and we'll have a proper announcement and presentation tomorrow. That happened today on a live call, which also featured Serena Williams coming on with a video of her own to say she was going to be there. So it was a big old deal.
Which was a surprise. Serena Williams wasn't billed as being part of that press conference, is that right?
No, she popped up midway through.
She was a sort of Madonna-style guest appearance.
Yeah, the whole thing was quite one of those quite surreal situations, and one that we're going to have to get used to of them hosting this virtual press conference again on video, where you've got the press officer emceeing it, you've got the tournament director, you've got Stacey Alistair, who's the new tournament director, you've got Katrina Adams, who's the previous chief exec of the USTA there, and there's basically just four of them inside the whole stadium talking to us all around the world on video.
And we've also had a separate announcement from the ATP about the intended tour schedule up to and including the French Open. And the WTA have announced an intended schedule as well. It wasn't a joint announcement, but it seemed like, at the very least, a coordinated announcement, unless it was an unrealistic coincidence that they dropped at the same time. But
it was very well coordinated. You're right, and the headlines of it are that the ATP tour will return on the 14th of August, and they're going to have a run into
Happy birthday, Dad. And my godson,
Catherine's
Rory.
Dad.
Big day.
It's a big Whittaker day. Okay, it's also a big tennis day. Washington, D.C. hosting the tournament on the 14th of August, followed by Cincinnati, but not in Cincinnati.
So
that's the world we're in now.
What does Cincinnati... I don't want to get too philosophical, but I also do want to get very philosophical about the fact that what is Cincinnati if it's not in Cincinnati?
It is the Western and Southern Open.
Yeah.
Sure.
They were very keen to stress that.
on the calendar, Western and Southern are delighted. On the calendar, it says Cincinnati played at Flushing Meadows.
Sure. Okay.
Basically what they want to do is that they're letting the players have a hotel from about the 15th of August in New York, a week before Cincinnati's due to start. There will be qualifying for Cincinnati. It sounds ridiculous me saying Cincinnati, doesn't it? But anyway, for that tournament, they're going to have a qualifying for that. They've got a doubles draw. They'll play that for a week, and then the US Open will start. That will not have any qualifying at all, which has caused major consternation out there.
But before we come on to that consternation, and obviously the consternation will be discussed in detail, there's also been an announcement of a post-US Open, pre-French Open calendar, which, drumroll please, need to retract all of my previous sniffiness about the potential for Kitzbühel to be... one of the big returning events of the tennis calendar, because, David, all of Dominic Thiem's dreams are coming true.
It's on, except the only problem is for Dominic Thiem, if he wants to play Kitzbühel, he's got to lose in New York.
He's got to play and lose the US Open. It's a real, what a Dominic Thiem conundrum.
Is he allowed to not play New York and play Kitzbühel instead?
No, they have introduced a rule which, let's face it, I think sounds like it's targeted specifically at Dominic Thiem, don't you think?
Absolutely. I mean, he's the only top 10 player who regularly plays Kitzbühel.
So the rule is that top 10 players are only allowed to enter Kitzbühel, which will be taking place during week 2 of the US Open, if they have entered the US Open. So they to prevent the top players from just saying, screw the US Open and that hard court swing, I'm coming back for the clay. It could be aimed at people that aren't Dominic Thiem. I just can't think of any specific people that aren't Dominic Thiem that might be aimed at.
He'd chosen defending his Kitzbühel title over the Olympics. So,
will he choose it over the US Open?
Fascinating. But you said he can't do that.
I mean, Matt has... Have you predicted him to win the US Open?
Yeah, loosely. back in the old world. Do you remember that?
Do you think he might... No, he can't.
He's not allowed to skip the US Open and play Kitzbühel.
Do you think he will lose round two if the US Open suspiciously... I've forgotten all the names of tennis players.
No, he won't.
Name me sort of a world number 78 that he might lose to suspiciously.
Andreas Seppi.
Yeah. that wasn't the sort of play. Anyone can lose to Andreas. He's the keep you honest kind of guy.
Yeah, I know. But so he'll put in a good solid 7 out of 10. And if Dominic chucks in a 5, he's out. So anyway.
Any other candidates? Can we remember any other male tennis players? Been a while, folks.
While you Google that.
Dennis Novak. His countryman.
Who was that bloke he lost to in Davis Cup last year?
Emil Ruusuvuori.
That guy.
Dominic Thiem lost to him. Yes, that's right.
Yeah.
So anyway, after Kitzbühel, there was some, by the way, there were some fantastic mocked up photos of Dominic Thiem and Kitzbühel stroking US Open.
It's gone meme-tastic and it's great.
Yeah. So after that, then there's Madrid, 13th of September, followed by Rome, 20th of September, followed by Paris, which has now moved back a further week from its original
Open,
placing
Paris,
of its...
Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, yes.
And there are no gaps between these events.
No.
They are one after the other. So we're looking at Western Southern Open, US Open, Madrid, Rome, Paris, consecutively.
It's like saying,
no,
you asked for tennis, folks. Here
is
all
the tennis. I
can't wait. It's going to be great.
And the WTA calendar... The wording of their calendar is slightly different, isn't it? It's not provisional. Intended, I think, is the word that they're using. Intended
proposed.
Calendar. Proposed calendar. There we go. How does that look?
Well, similar in the first part of it, in that they've got the Cincinnati inverted commas event.
We need to stop calling it that. Nothing is happening in the city of Cincinnati.
The New York qualifying week. But that's not qualifying. Okay.
The Western event, Southern Open.
The words have ceased to mean the things that they used to mean. Everything's
weird. They've
beaten
me. The Western Southern Open is a mixed men and women event. So that's,
do you think Western and Southern will start sending us money if we keep up like this?
Nope. So they have they've got their event the week before the US Open.
All of the events that the ATP have announced, bar Kitzbühel, are combined events, right?
Yes.
Cincinnati / not Cincinnati, Washington, which is...
Washington's not actually currently on the WTA calendar, although there is a TBD in the week of the 10th. And that usually is a combined event,
yeah,
isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely.
But there is an event even earlier on the WTA calendar, which is Palermo, on the 3rd of August. Then later on, there's also Istanbul. I think the big difference here is that they've put their proposed calendar all the way through to the end of the year.
Mm.
So in
and it includes a lot of Asian swing
events.
Yeah, but
if you remember when Roland Garros moved its dates, it suddenly clashed with Wuhan. Now Wuhan has moved itself back, so it's the actual Asian swing after Roland Garros finishes starts with Beijing, which is actually a huge tournament, premier mandatory tournament, straight off the back of the French Open. That used to be after Wuhan. Well, now it's before, and Wuhan is the week after on October the 19th. And then there are other events like Moscow, Tokyo, and then they've got the WTA finals scheduled for the 9th of November in Shenzhen, still as it originally was. So the calendar on the women's side runs all the way to the end of November, which is a good month longer, maybe even more than the calendar would normally be. On the men's side, at the moment, there is no categoric decision taken on or even proposed calendar being released for the Asian swing or for Paris indoors or for the ATP finals. But from what I was reading this evening, they've obviously been asked about that, and the intention is certainly to play the ATP finals in London as originally planned. Whether fans can come along is another matter. Obviously, we know the situation. We'll have to wait and see when we get there. But I think that their plan would be to try to get that played no matter what, because they rely on it for finance just the same way as the USTA relies on the US Open.
Yeah, my understanding is that it's pretty critical that ATP Finals takes place, be it regrettably behind closed doors or I mean, obviously the ideal scenario with crowds, but that feels given that it's in the UK, potentially quite fanciful at the moment. But I think the ATP, just as the WTA, are in a similar position, very, very incentivized for that to happen.
On the subject of fans, the French Open also held some kind of video conference today and had a big press release. And they're saying that they intend to have fans. They at the French Open, they don't know what percentage it will be. I think they're in discussions with the French government about that, and it will be maybe a last minute decision, perhaps, or certainly within a few weeks they will decide that. They're not definitive at the moment, but they are planning to have fans. So that will obviously be very different to the US Open, which is behind closed doors completely.
Yeah, and that is, am I right in saying that's pretty unequivocal? Whereas the French Open are kind of leaving the whole fans thing pretty open, the US Open are saying it is going to be behind closed doors. There's nothing re the pandemic and the situation that can change between now and those dates that will change the situation with fans. And they've announced pretty clearly and in quite a lot of detail, albeit some details are a bit different to what was sort of previously hinted at, what the rules and regulations are going to be for players, haven't they?
Yeah. I mean, the reason they're able to get this off the ground and get the pass from the governor of New York to do this is because they've put in such strict measures in order to, in inverted commas, guarantee safety of people and to assure the authorities that they are not going to cause a problem here. And that means having a kind of bubble, really, for the players so that, I mean, if you imagine the size of the National Tennis Center in New York, let alone the Arthur Ashe Stadium, but the whole complex is so big and there won't be anybody in it other than players and officials. So it's an enormous space. Now, they've already figured out sort of areas that they can have for playing football and basketball and all sorts of things like this. They're going to give all 32 seeds a suite around the Arthur Ashe Stadium to have as a sort of warm-up area and a sort of personal area. They're going to get all the players in a hotel, a specific hotel, I think at JFK
airport. Yes, it's an airport hotel. It's called. Yeah. It looks
and
glamorous.
The alternative for them is to rent a house.
Has anyone ever stayed in an airport hotel for more than one night?
Well, if you win the US Open and you don't go for the house option, which they've obviously laid on
after lots of
complaints.
Okay, imagine you do the Western and Southern Open and then win the US Open. That's potentially a plus quarantine.
It's a month.
That's like more than a month in an airport hotel.
Yeah. So there won't be too many of those players who say, I don't like spending all my time at the site. They're all going to be spending all their time at the site because they're clearly going to turn the US Open grounds into Disneyland in order to make it, they're going to have every possible creature comfort there for them and entertainment so that they don't have to go anywhere else and they can keep tabs on them at all times. I mean, they're going to test them, they said, ahead of the event and at least once in a week and probably more.
And then if someone were to break protocol, they would have to be tested pretty much daily, they were saying.
And crucially, they seem to have eliminated the discussed rule that Novak Djokovic had preemptively opposed, which was a restriction of one entourage member per player. They've said that they will reserve one extra room per player, but they will only the player will be paid for in terms of their accommodation and expenses, but they will have the right to one additional room, which will be the financial responsibility of the player. But the kind of unwritten small print is you can bring extra people if you want. We won't prevent you from doing that. We just aren't laying on the facilities to make that easier.
And they
for
haven't
you.
Actually made their decision yet about whether they can bring more than one person on to the site. They're still working that out. They've had some backlash
about that. Novak
Djokovic
is his personal chef is waiting by the phone to hear.
Yeah, I mean, look, when Lopez was asked about this on this media call, he was very, very respectful to players like Novak and many others. And he said, look, if players don't want to come, I really respect that. I understand that. He said, for me, the entourage issue, it is a sacrifice, but it is a small sacrifice, in my opinion. But it's up to them. If they don't want to do it, I understand it. But we can't not have the tournament because of that. What I sensed was he also said, we've also got to understand that there's still 2 months to go yet. And the USTA have made us feel that things may well be better by then, and they may be able to actually do more for them by that time.
I mean, I suppose it's also possible that it could go the other way and things could get worse in the next 2 months. We don't really know.
The thing may well not happen yet.
Yeah.
I think we all need to bear that in mind. These are plans, and they have said that the event is going ahead. The governor has said it can go ahead, but that's under current day conditions. Who knows whether a second wave might have happened by then that just Indian Wells style makes somebody go, no, that's not happening.
And I certainly think that that's even more of a thing to bear in mind with the later dates on the provisional calendar that's been announced, because in Catherine Speaks Beyond her scientific and medical brief news, that though there is no definitive data on COVID and the way it's impacted by temperature, traditionally viruses are less contagious in warm weather. So it's likely that the current trends that we're seeing, though we don't know for sure, it's likely that the current trends we're seeing are impacted by the weather in the Northern Hemisphere. And as things do start to get cooler into the autumn, which is when it's pretty deep into the autumn, actually, really, that the French Open is scheduled to happen, that could become a factor. But yeah, we should probably deviate before I speak even more beyond my scientific brief. But it's absolutely worth bearing in mind before we get too carried away. Now, cue getting really carried away.
We were going to say before we book flights. Well, nobody will be booking flights because the media are not allowed in. They have said that some broadcast partners will be allowed to go. I don't exactly know what that means, but the media were told on this call they won't be credentialed for the tournament. So, you know, which is no great surprise. I mean,
and that's the US Open you're talking about there.
Yeah. Yeah. So,
and look, preemptively, there was a lot of dissent from players, particularly on the ATP side. A few stray voices here and there on the WTA side, but a lot of ATP players have been quite outspoken about their feelings about the US Open going ahead and subsequent to the announcement that has. Yeah, nothing has changed. There's today, sort of a few hours, day or so after the announcement, there was a post by Gabby Dabrowski, WTA player, mostly in doubles, very considered post, headlined "My Personal Thoughts on the US Open Moving Forward," which, I mean, there are plenty of players who have said plenty of things and made plenty of arguments about why they're opposed to it happening. But I think her post probably sums up or covers most of them and is certainly extremely eloquently expressed. So I'll summarize her, the points that she's made, to give you a view of what and why the players are opposing this decision. She says, with respect, while I'm appreciative that the US Open put forth big efforts to operate, I have many concerns. Here is my perspective. And it's bullet pointed. She says, when the US Open presented their plan, it felt like being sold on an idea, telling us that testing is over 90% accurate when we know it's around 70%. Well, I mean, that's... we hear all sorts of things about testing, don't we? Anyway, but that's what she says. She says that gives the impression that health and safety of players are not the priority. In reality, most decisions had already been made, so player feedback wasn't really taken into consideration. She said it's impossible to control and enforce a bubble situation where players only move from the hotel to the venue and back. We don't know who players will come into contact with, and those that don't obey put everyone else in the tournament at risk. She says at least half of players are not comfortable travelling to the US. She doesn't give any sort of specific evidence for that. And presumably she is in contact with other players, but I don't know how that claim can be backed up. But anyway, that's what she says. She says at least half of players, lots of players disappointed with no qualifying, no mixed, and half a doubles draw. Not having qualifying and a smaller doubles draw increases the lack of parity in tennis. We don't want to disproportionately move the needle further, creating a bigger gap between those at the top and those who need the income and opportunity for growth. She says the beauty of a slam is the story of the qualifier who battled three tough matches to earn their spot in the main draw and get the upset. This story will not exist at this year's US Open. She said the beauty of a slam is mental fortitude and the skill it takes to win six doubles matches. The beauty of a slam is having the opportunity to play mixed doubles, a unique aspect of tennis. There is a concern with the exhaustive nasal testing, she says. It would not be occasional, but multiple times a week. It's an uncomfortable test that hasn't proven accurate, and to be subject to it that often is a source of anxiety for players. And she says the consequence of testing positive on site means an immediate withdrawal no matter what round you're in and staying in a hotel room until you test negative. Even without symptoms, this could mean you're isolated for weeks on end, unable to play further events or even go home. She says, I wish we could use this hiatus to explore new designs of how and where we play tennis, like some real out-of-the-box thinking.
I mean, what I would say is the beauty of a slam stuff. Well, yeah, when there's not a pandemic on,
yeah.
is my argument in response to that. Yeah, love to, absolutely. It's terrible that qualifying can't take place. It's terrible that there's half a doubles draw. It's terrible that there's so many parts of a slam that wouldn't normally happen. There's no fans in the stadium. There's no atmosphere that you'd normally get. There's no wheelchair competition. There's so much that's not going to be that we regard as a slam. So the question is, do you run it or don't you run it? And I think if you can run it, you run it, because the sport needs it. And I mean, I know Judy Murray feels strongly that there's a fairness issue in terms of there are certain players around the world who just may not be able to get there. And I look at if that ends up being the case, and you think of the degrees to which the coronavirus has hit players in South America or regions in South America at the moment, and we've still got 2 months to go, who knows how bad it's going to get. But if you just wrote off the rest of the year when you can play, I think that the tours and the tournaments have a duty to try to make this happen somehow in order to create an economy that can sustain tennis in the long run, because no amount of out-of-the-box thinking is just going to magic up an equivalent to the US Open.
Yeah, I entirely agree. I mean, I don't specifically disagree with anything that she says, or it's not that I think any of the dissenting voices from players are wrong specifically, or that they don't make valid points. I just think potentially a lot of them don't realise how high the stakes are. I mean, the impression I get is that this is the future of the sport on the line. This is the very existence of the ATP, the WTA, the Grand Slams on the line. And these events going ahead or not going ahead could be the difference between those institutions and organisations continuing and not continuing. And while in the micro sense, obviously there are issues of parity and fairness. Obviously there are. This is not ideal. I mean, this pandemic is exacerbating and showing up issues of fairness and equality across the board. And, you know, that's for the long run to deal with. I can't argue that this is a fair solution, but not going ahead with it when it's possible, even in compromised conditions, will, it seems to me, lead to greater long-run inequality and unfairness and destitution, really. And, you know, it would be a very, very strange situation if we were all sitting here in August or September and people were saying, there could be tennis happening now. And it just wasn't happening. I know there's sort of a human desire for black and white and clarity, and that's been shown up in lots of ways by this whole situation. You know, I found lockdown, I found the regulations a lot easier, actually, when we were in total lockdown and it was all extremely clear and we were all in it together. It was dreadful, but at least it was clear cut. And everyone was in the same situation. And now it's all sort of ragged and frayed and inequitable. And there's something really anxiety inducing about that on a human level. And I totally understand that human response. But we are where we are. This is extremely unideal. And the thought of just being sat around in September knowing that tennis could be being played, but we'd sort of made some blanket decision that it shouldn't be in 2020, and we should just, you know, let's call the whole thing off and start again in 2021, which frankly is what I was saying 6 weeks ago. And now I sort of know more about the situation and what the stakes are. I think that seems silly, even though the scenario we're faced with is very, very far from ideal.
Yeah, it was hearing and reading Lopez's comments that really crystallised just how severe the financial implications of all this are to me. I was aware that, obviously, you know, there was a lot at stake, but I hadn't quite realised how much was at stake until Lopez put it the way he did. So I think, you know, 6 weeks ago, 8 weeks ago, the start of lockdown, I had an image in my mind of the return to tennis being this wonderful thing to celebrate, that, you know, how great it will be when tennis is back. It will just, you know, I probably naively thought at the start that it would kind of go back to normal and we would all be going to the first event back and how great that would be. But slowly it's become clear that is not the case. And I hear all the concerns about fairness, and I sympathize massively with all those players. I particularly sympathize with players who, I remember Simon talking about it at the start of this process, that squeezed middle, those ones who are not financially able to just sit out events if they don't feel safe. And I wouldn't, you know, hold it against those players who do that, because I think it's a perfectly legitimate response to not be comfortable with this. But there will be some players out there who don't feel safe, but also are now in a situation where tennis is starting. So they're kind of feeling compelled to go to events that they don't want to go to chase money, to chase opportunity, to chase ranking points. And it's going to be incredibly difficult for them. It's an incredibly unfortunate situation. But yeah, the future of the sport is at stake. And if we can get the US Open running, and I'm encouraged that the ATP Challenger Tour is also going to be starting up at the same time as the ATP Tour, which I imagine would be more domestic, but it should give hopefully some sort of chance for lower ranked players to play, to start earning some money. I don't know what they're going to do about points. They haven't specified that yet. That obviously is an important currency for players, but the ITF Tour is starting. Opportunities will be coming again for lower ranked players. It's not fair, but it's, as you said, it's seems necessary. And I think that's just the situation we're in now.
Oh, cheery, cheery.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Guys, it's going to be rubbish, but rubbish is the best we can expect. Give us some, make it sound great, David. Come on.
Well, Serena Williams sounded like she was up for it.
That really is big, isn't it?
It was huge. It was a big moment, yeah. Actually. And look, there is star power right there. And not only her as an individual, but given what she's got on the line, this is a chance for her now.
I'm getting carried away now. I'm doing the David Law optimism train. But imagine if this were the slam.
Oh, it would be a
where
great
she did 24.
Troll.
It would be the. It would. That, I mean, that would. Be, I mean, start writing the film script now, just in case.
Yeah, well, because people will be saying this is the asterisk slam.
Who cares? A lot of and Margaret Courts were the asterisk slam.
She is trying to match the asterisk record, let's be honest.
I think there were 11 times that Margaret Court won slams in her 24, which were in Australia, when half the world wasn't playing. And that's why we know there's an asterisk against that, but actually on the whole... How often does anybody ever talk about that outside of our little circle? It doesn't get talked about. So there's so many people who've replied to us discussing the subject saying the way this will turn out will be a massive asterisk against this tournament and it just doesn't count. Well, I get the point and that there are, but that will not be remembered in the long run. Not really. Because there are so many where players have either got injured or, nobody says Sue Barker won the French Open. Oh, and by the way, Chris Evert wasn't playing.
I also think to an extent, and this is probably unfair, but to an extent it depends who it is. I think I've driven myself down an avenue I can't get out of because I can't remember any tennis player names. But if the world number 140 wins it, it will suddenly look like more of an asterisk than if Serena Williams wins it, or even if, help me out with the tennis player, Matt.
What a good one. Or
give me a sort of,
Bianca Andreescu.
Give me a 10 to 20 non-Grand Slam champion.
Arketa Vondrousova.
Yeah. Well, no, she's a Grand Slam finalist. Okay. Give me like a... think of tennis players.
Catherine. People
think
are shouting.
Keys.
Yeah, okay.
Johanna Konta.
Yeah, exactly. Suddenly it will... I mean, it's all... As much as we think it will... It's sort of objective how big the asterisk will be. Actually, it'll be a postscript, the asterisk. And, if Serena Williams and let's say, obviously Roger Federer won't be winning it, and we'll come on to why in a moment. I'm sure you all know why because it's old news by now. But let's say Novak Djokovic, as much as he's talked a big game, I just have a sneaky feeling he's going to end up playing the US Open. If Serena Williams and Novak Djokovic win it, the asterisk will be smaller than if, insert tennis players here, Matt, or David, anyone, help me out.
Elena Rybakina Francis Tiafoe.
I'm on my second beer, by the way, everybody. Catherine's on the gin.
Do you know what I mean? It's not an objectively sized asterisk.
I agree. And I also think it feels like a bit bigger asterisk at the moment, because we've been so used to having reliably good slams in the last 20 or 30 years with no asterisk whatsoever. You know, everyone's been there barring injury. They've been this big, huge event, well attended, and they've felt massive. Now we're taking away.
There was a time when Thomas Johansson was winning slams.
And there was a time when people weren't going to the Australian Open.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Even 25 years ago, you know, John McEnroe didn't go for most of his career.
There was a time when Chris Evert wasn't going to the French Open.
Mm. Lots of people didn't play Wimbledon.
Because of world team tennis, you know.
Gustavo Kuerten and Yannick Noah, they won the French Open and didn't necessarily play Wimbledon. Mm. Ivan Lendl skipped the French Open to prepare for Wimbledon twice. Does that make the French Open an asterisk because he was the world number one back then?
Mm.
I don't think of it like that, personally. Look, I know this is more severe in terms of this is a global pandemic and there's no crowd and all. I get all the points. But
who will thrive in the no crowd environment?
Well, you had a good shout the other day, I thought.
I said Kiki Buttons and Stefanos Tsitsipas.
Carolina Pliskova.
Because Tsitsipas looks completely irritated when he's got, you know, most of a stadium full of Greek fans in. He sort of looks like, oh, I know I have to kind of look like I'm delighted by this, but it is, frankly, an irritation.
He quite likes his own company, doesn't he?
Yeah. And Kiki Buttons is very open about the fact that she doesn't enjoy the big stage and the big exposure. So those are my picks.
Let's go. I mean, look, we've got another 2 months to do that.
You think Carolina Pliskova doesn't like the crowds?
Well, I think she's just perfectly capable of just quietly going and winning an event, as long as she doesn't have too much...
Yeah.
Razzmatazz to worry about.
Who will be...
She's going to win the Western and Southern Open. She's the she's the pre-slam queen.
And then we'll all go,
queen.
She's going to win it.
I think she's going to win all 10 events that are left on the calendar.
Will they play the Western and Southern Open on different courts to the US Open to
make it feel different
somehow? So feel different?
Well, we should just go back to the Serena Williams point as well, because... Just slotted into this press conference was the news that she had brought in the exact court surface and had it installed in her home in order to get practice. Which, because it isn't, am I right in thinking, Matt, it's a new surface this year?
It's a new hard court surface. And yeah, Stacey Allister, who, by the way, baptism of fire, new US Open tournament director,
yep,
just sort of casually dropped it in that they'd sent her this new surface and she'd had it installed in her home, which is, I was surprised she was so open about that.
Do you think the previous tournament director, do you remember during the, when there was a change of government in the UK during the financial crash, the previous chancellor, or maybe it was the permanent secretary of the treasurer, left a note in the treasury saying there's no money? Do you think it was like that with the previous tournament director of the US Open? Good luck, there's a pandemic. Enjoy.
I feel like she knew what she was getting herself into.
Before we start talking about who might win it, and let's face it, we've got 2 months to do that.
No one said we were going to talk about who might win it, David. I'm presenting this thing, and
we've
that
just been
was
doing
not,
it.
It wasn't a
you
raid
started
that was going
it.
To go down. No, when did I? When did I?
Well, with your Kiki Buttons chat. Right.
No, I said who would enjoy and thrive in a no crowd environment. No one talked about winning it.
All right. Well, what about this then? Who is not going to play?
Roger Federer,
everybody, if you hadn't seen, is injured and out for the rest of the year. Although he made it quite clear he didn't fancy no crowd tennis whatsoever. So he's not playing. Novak Djokovic has used the words extreme to describe the conditions that they would have to play in and the lack of team members and not staying in Manhattan and that kind of thing. Rafael Nadal did a big conference call a couple of weeks ago in which he said, you know, if I'd got to make the decision right now, I wouldn't want to go. But there's a couple of months to go yet, but he clearly isn't that keen. And I think that the bigger point is that the French Open and the clay swing is straight after it. Now, does he just think, do you know what? I can, this year, Roger Federer is not playing. I can draw level with him with one more. Maybe I should, maybe I just cut my losses and go straight to Madrid.
Can't play Kitchbühel though.
No.
Think twice about that, Rafa. Nick Kyrgios is just staying on the fence with his opinions.
Nick Kyrgios is just trolling the whole process and doesn't, to my mind, seem to have an awful lot of
I think he's still to it. Still drinking that bottle of red wine he was on when he did the Instagram live with Andy Murray that was swiftly deleted.
I mean, I understand he's of the view, or he's been stating that tennis shouldn't come back while there's so much going on in the world. And well,
he's just travelled over to Europe to play in an exhibition tour.
I don't know if he's travelled yet, but his name is down to play in Berlin.
His name's on. Whether he plays,
whether he does or not, I mean, surely not.
I don't really care, to be honest, that much about what he's got to say about it. I'm more interested in what other people might or might not do.
Well,
Simona Halep has said, as things stand, she's not going to play, but she is open, I think, to having her mind changed. I'd be surprised, personally.
And she was one of the few tennis players who pulled out of the Rio Olympics with the concerns over Zika, so that it is actually quite in line with her previous thinking on all this.
Mm.
Personally, I think Djokovic probably will play.
Mm, I do too.
I think they've slightly ceded some of the what he was calling extreme measures. I still think he's broadly against them, but I think there's enough wiggle room now that he can probably play. But I would think Nadal might not, as you were saying, the prospect of US Open, Madrid, Rome, French Open consecutively, I think he might struggle with, and I think he would favour, obviously, the French Open, being in prime form for those 2 weeks.
I don't think Nadal can win both. Even with a depleted field, even with him at his best just physically.
I don't think Djokovic can win both either.
Well, that means probably no one can win both.
I think he could win one or the other, maybe, but I don't think he would win the French Open, really.
So then maybe logically it would make more sense for him to play the US because Nadal's the roadblock at the French.
Mm. That's
Nadal's a bigger roadblock at the French than the rest of the field is at the US Open.
I mean, Djokovic said, I'm more likely to start my season in September in Europe. Now, I totally get the reasons why. I really do. But same time, it's a heck of an opportunity, isn't it, to just no Federer, maybe no Nadal, maybe depleted further. There may be no Wawrinka. There are suggestions he might not play. Not sure team will play. So suddenly, I mean, and look,
Wawrinka needs the crowd?
Djokovic beats virtually all of these people anyway. But it's a hell of an opportunity.
But I think Wawrinka needs crowd. Well, Ash Barty has expressed reservations, hasn't she?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I think that, look, there will be some players who don't play.
Have we heard from Andreescu?
Most will. I haven't heard from her, no. I think most players will play, personally. But
I do too. I feel like we're at the lowest ebb at the moment regarding player opinions.
But the only big thing is what happens between now and then, virus-wise, because it could get worse. And
it could.
That may well change things.
It could. I've already done my scientific corner. I won't delve further.
I am interested to see what they do to make it a better experience, given there are no fans.
What would you like them to do?
Well, I've been watching some of this football.
Play Sweet Caroline at the changeovers.
I mean, they do that anyway.
Well,
they will do that. I'm sure they won't.
You can't play boppy pop music to an empty.
I'm sure they will.
You've got to play like lo-fi morose music.
No, they'll try and fill every silence, I'm sure of it.
It'll just echo.
I think the key...
You can't have Neil Diamond echoing round 20,000 Caesars Stadium.
I bet you they do.
No.
They will.
I mean, they've been...
It's been all right in the football, I think, tonight.
Well, but I don't think you can pump crowd noise into tennis as easy as you can football. With football, there's a constant hum.
Tell that, Matt, to the 2008 Istanbul Open Champions Tour event.
It's a bit niche. Go on, Catherine. What happened there?
I remember you talked about this.
My first ever sort of post-university job, I suppose. I'd just been employed by David Law, nightmare boss, dreadful. My first ever solo event assignment was to go to Istanbul, Turkey, to cover a Champions Tour event with, among other players, Goran Ivanišević, Pat Cash, Sergi Bruguera.
And what did they do?
Cedric Pirlin, I think, was there. Anyway, it was July 2008. I've not been to Istanbul in other months. I can only assume it's more bearable. I loved the city, but climate-wise, in July, it was simply not the conditions in which human life can survive.
too hot.
It was outside of air conditioning. It was a wilt, wither and die situation. So obviously nobody turned up for this outdoor event. It was a really great event otherwise. It was a shame, but there was no crowd to speak of because it was impossible to be outside for more than 1.5 seconds at a time. So they just ploughed on and pumped in crowd noise. And I'd never experienced that before at a tennis event or since. It was deeply weird. marginally better than...
Okay,
question. They're not doing this in the stadium, though, are they? They're only doing this for the TV viewer, Matt, on these matches we're watching.
Agreed, but I don't... But you've got to have someone... But with football, it's a constant hum of noise. With tennis, it's sort of rise and fall of noise.
So you'll have to have a sort of sound mixer.
Yeah. You would, yeah. I reckon they'd a little bit of hubbub sort of at the US Open from what they normally have is something they should put in for a start as a baseline.
Okay, sorry, Matt, carry on.
Well, yes. I mean, I agree because I think tennis is a uniquely... bad sport when there's no noise whatsoever. I'm sorry, it is miserable.
Mind you, we do like the silence at the Wimbledon final, don't we? When they're coming up to match point, and then it all goes quiet.
Yes, yeah, but exactly. But the rise and fall of noise is the hush.
Only good because of what precedes and follows it.
Yes, it's all about
the
environment and the context and the contrast. If you've just got tennis in an empty stadium,
yeah.
Is a thoroughly miserable experience. I'm sorry, it is.
Yeah,
we've all watched it and hated it and commented on it in the past.
23,000 seater.
Yeah, I mean, and we're going to realise that what makes these events is the connection between the players and the fans. And I agree, there's nothing they can really do about, you know, fans having fans on site. It's the right decision not to have them. But I just think they need to think of something for the broadcast to make it more watchable. And I don't know what that is. I would say it's more coaching. It's more headset coaching, miking players up. It's stuff like that, yeah. I think.
But you hate that, Matt.
I know, but this is where we're at, right? I would prefer that to
David,
nothing at all.
David, as somebody who... is facing the prospect of radio commentary on crowd-free Grand Slam tennis. Yeah. And I make that point because, I mean, the effects are amplified in importance on the radio. They're so crucial. And I think you are somebody that I think you're a master at using those and harmonizing with those effects. How was it going to be?
Well, thank you very much. How's it going to be? Oh, that's a good question.
Have you had a chance to think about, you know, how you'll do that job, you know,
I mean, in those circumstances? I have commentated on very... I tell you where I did a match. I remember doing an Australian Open match with Joe Konta against Garbiñe Muguruza, and it was 3:30 a.m. and there was hardly anybody in the stadium.
I remember it vividly.
Yeah,
I do too, because I was waiting in the bowels of that stadium for an interview.
So
not that's yawning at all.
Probably the closest that I can get to, because you would still hear a bit of clapping from the entourages and stuff like that.
That was the match that they were going to move to court too, but they couldn't because of pigeon poo.
That's correct. The one. Oh, don't you love tennis? Oh, so, look, I have to say, I got into that match. I felt able to commentate
on that
match.
Well, you can get into anything.
But I think I was able to deliver hopefully an exciting listen without it seeming absurd, because that's the key. You don't want to sound ridiculous.
Mm.
But I think that given – it depends what it is. I mean, if it's not a match that would appeal to my audience necessarily on its own and there's no atmosphere, then I'm afraid you do end up – you lower your own tone and you end up talking about something else to some degree. If there's a crowd – even if it's not that interesting necessarily name-wise to the audience back home, you kind of go with it because the crowd, that you've got to be able to explain what this sound is all about, why it matters. So I can't get around it. I mean, it's going to be weird, but I feel that we will all adjust because we don't have any choice. This is sport now for the foreseeable future, and we will all get used to it. It's like watching tennis relived and starting in 1983. We get used to the pace and then adjust.
How do you feel about watching Fulham play a playoff with no crowd, Matt? I mean, maybe you feel great about it because playoffs are, let's face it, with the benefit of distance, excruciating.
Oh, absolutely. And as I've said, I do think that football is in an easier situation to improve the TV experience than tennis. I think tennis is a struggle. It really is. And I don't envy those people who have to make those decisions of how they are going to improve it.
Mm. Oh, hang on. Me and David are those people, aren't we? David and I.
You mean the organisers, don't you?
Oh, you mean the organisers, not the producers, not the people that have
the world feed producers and all those sort of people who are sending these pictures around. Well, you'll be the ones receiving the pictures and commenting on them. But I suppose the point is there something that can be done special effects wise and audio wise? Within the broadcast, in order to elevate it,
virtual reality, you know, like a Keith Urban hologram type thing.
Well, I mean, they've got video walls up during this Manchester City Arsenal match that I'm watching, showing people at home watching who've all video called in. I mean, it looks okay. They're in the eye line of the players by the looks of it. They're behind the goal.
It sounds exhilarating, David.
I mean, the main thing is the sound is okay because they've brought in the underlying sound of the crowd singing, not celebrate. I'm not sure what they do when they celebrate a goal. I haven't actually seen a goal go in yet. So you're right. The problem will be is how do you then raise it when somebody's just hit a screaming winner? You know, if you got somebody who got the right bank of sound effects for any given day, tournament, experience, and you've got somebody who really knew tennis who was controlling the faders, the dials on the mixing desk, you could do it. I'm sure you could do it.
What do you think post-match press conferences and so on will look like? Is it going to be like the daily coronavirus briefing?
I imagine it will be what they had today.
Yeah, it'll all be Zoom calls. They'll bring somebody into an interview room. We'll all be on the line and we'll put our names down for a question if we've got one, and then they'll come to you. There are a couple of things that do bother me about that. One is that suddenly the journalists today were part of the broadcast and they're on the screen and everybody's seeing them. And that's okay. That's something that has happened more recently in the last couple of years at the US Open, but it does bother me that suddenly, you know, we haven't really asked to be on the camera in a press conference room and there you are for everybody to see. The other one
means you've got to put makeup on. And
well, I mean, suddenly I'm seeing inside the houses of people that are really wasn't expecting to see.
John Legend and his, my Grammys just happened to be behind me.
No, I didn't see any of those.
There isn't a camera angle in my house that doesn't have Grammys in it.
And then there is the other element is just there are no media on site. So how can you do any meaningful journalism to ask questions, question the organisation?
That is an important point. I mean, I know this isn't, politics, etc. And, you know, the stakes aren't quite as high in terms of the need for scrutiny and holding truth to power and all of that. But journalism has its very, very important place in sport, and these conditions diminish the power and reach and place of it.
Some of the best stories that come out of the US Open or any slam are when Chris Clary from the New York Times is having a chat with somebody in a corridor.
Absolutely.
And he can't do that. And we're just going to have to accept that for now, because I don't see any other way around it, except that he'll probably be on the phone to anybody who needs to talk to and they'll pick up the phone.
Well, hopefully to us as well. Yeah. We've already gone over time because I'm not used to presenting this thing. And I'm obviously less stringent about the whole thing than David is. I'll give you both 2 minutes to talk about the Ultimate Tennis Showdown and the Adria Tour. Off you go.
Matt, you can take the Ultimate Tennis Showdown.
Thank you. I've been waiting for this moment. I mean, to be honest, I'm torn between not wanting...
It is ultimate, Matt. Before you say anything, do be aware that it is ultimate. There isn't... The definition of ultimate means there is nothing greater.
I mean, and it's questionable whether it's tennis. I mean, I'm torn between not wanting to give it any airtime and go on a sort of furious rant about it. I feel like I want to have Marina Hyde's opinion. Oh. I just want a column from Marina Hyde, and so she can gloriously dismantle it in one column. Gosh, what to say? I mean, the basic idea of using an exhibition to experiment, I am on board with, and I think exhibitions should look different to what we see normally, because otherwise kind of what's the point of having them? But that's kind of where it should end. And what really frustrates me and riles me is the way that Muratoglu is talking about this event as reinventing tennis, and he's doing that on a kind of mountain of theory built on a molehill of evidence, it seems, that he's got this bogus report that the average age of the tennis viewer is 61, which was, as far as I can tell, is a report into just the United States, just people watching on TV. And he's sort of used that as a way of saying that tennis needs reinvention. And I agree, the idea to speed up tennis is probably a noble one, but to restrict it to four sort of time zones of 10 minutes and having these UTS cards that you're throwing in, which are gimmicks essentially, and saying that that could be the future of tennis. I'm here if the ATP Tour and the WTA Tour want me. No, I'm sorry. I find it quite insulting, actually, that's his idea. I think it's an impenetrable scoring system that will gain no new fans and lose current fans. And the whole thing is a massive turn off, in my opinion. Was that two minutes?
That was absolutely great. You've got 1.5 seconds, David, to summarise the Adria tour.
Well, before I do that, I mean, I thought that was majestic. I mean, I really rate the entrepreneurial spirit, I've said that before, of people who are prepared to go out on a limb and put on something during these times, because it ain't easy. There are one or two bits of what I saw over the weekend that I quite enjoyed when they did
Was it the a cappella rendition of A Change Is Gonna Come?
No, it wasn't that. I actually liked the idea. It's the first time I've ever seen it, of the headset interviews with players. I actually liked the concept of it. I didn't think it always yielded good results, but I liked the concept of it. Fair enough. And I think that's absolutely right to try, miking up the players, yeah, kind of thing.
And that isn't a change to tennis's scoring system. You know, stuff like I'm on board with.
Yeah. And, you know, if you want to run this concept at your academy and have whatever scoring system you like, that's fine. But I mean, I really don't see that there will be much of a clamor for it anywhere. I know it's early days, but I found it incredibly confusing. I found clearly the players did as well. And I mean, you know, I'm sure they get to grips with things, etc. I saw a player top edge of a forehand deliberately out the stadium because the time was running down and he didn't need to win the point. And I just thought, that's not tennis to me. And I actually heard Patrick Mouratoglou say that, I love tennis. I love what it is already. I'm trying to add to it, which again is fair enough. I just don't see this going anywhere, really. I just don't see it going anywhere.
And I just think it's kind of big stick policy. You know, it's speak softly and carry a big stick is what he should be doing. You know, he talks this massive game, and then he presents us with this, and it just doesn't add up.
I mean, I agree with you, David, about the entrepreneurial spirit, and I agree with you, Matt, about I'm totally on board with experimentation and innovation in exhibition tennis, and there is a place for exhibition tennis. There is a place for exhibition tennis, but it just needs to know its place. And I think the one thing that doesn't need messing with in tennis, and it's not even really a point for debate, is its scoring system. It's a Rubik's cube in its beauty. It's just utter perfection. And I realize, you know, in some exhibition formats, you might want to shortened fast falls or what. I mean, I have issues with those, but I think fundamentally messing with the scoring system is altering it from what makes it tennis, because what makes tennis wonderful is the scoring system is integral to that. Anyway, Adria Tour, anyone?
Well, Adria Tour looked, if the Adria Tour was part of last year's tennis circuit in pre-pandemic times, it would look fantastic. It was clearly brilliantly staged and put on from a standing start. They'd got great crowds. They'd got great presentation. I actually enjoyed the first of four games in that particular exhibition format. I thought it all worked. It's just that we've got a pandemic on at the moment. And I know that Serbia has not been badly hit. They've done an excellent job in that part of the world. And I know this because my wife is Croatian. And in Croatia, the neighboring country, they have very, very few cases. And that's because they locked down immediately and they were stringent and they've kept it down. But tennis played there in Belgrade was exactly as you see it when there isn't any pandemic anywhere in the world. Full crowd, towels being used, picked up by ball kids, handshakes at the net, players hugging, football matches between the players beforehand, high fives, going to a big party afterwards, dancing on stage together, all of this kind of stuff. Players who'd flown in to the tournament on private jets from all around Europe. And look, maybe absolutely nothing will happen to anybody, and I absolutely hope that's the case, and probably it will be the case, but it looked really, really questionable to me. And I think that is probably the main problem, not the actual tangible effects that maybe there might be a spread of the infection caused by this. It's just that it felt like it was telling the world, everything's all right, don't worry about it. We can, you know, in this part of the world, we can do what we like. But I think that there is another message that sends out. People like Novak Djokovic and Dominic Thiem and Alexander Zverev, they all have huge followings, and people are seeing them just acting as though nothing's going on in the world. And I just think it gives a message across that that's how it is.
Yeah, completely agree.
And a message for people that's not how it is. That, you know, that, as I said, the difficulties at the moment of we're not all in this together anymore. You know, there are some people that are still shielding. There are some people that have, you know, we're still in the period of people being told, well, certainly in this country, I know in some other countries, that if you're vulnerable, you can't leave the house, you know. And I just think it's, and I don't expect people that are able to leave the house to not leave the house just because, you know, some people aren't able to. But it feels really, you know, the videos of them sweatily dancing at a club together, and the video of them all playing a pre-event football match where they all hug during a goal celebration, it felt like almost gratuitously emphasising, look how normal and huggy we are. And I just think, for various reasons, sort of emotional, moral, it just, even if not practically wrong, it just doesn't feel right on a number of levels.
The Serbian authorities do have different rules there to what we have here in the UK, and I fully accept that. They did nothing legally wrong at all, from what we understand. But I just feel that tone-wise, they just should have thought that through a bit more and made some adjustments. That's my feeling on it.
And that is something to say, that as much as I dislike the actual event that Muratoglu has put on, at least he is providing an event that is seemingly done with social distancing and safely and allowing the players an opportunity to play, which I get and understand. And they could have done that on the Adria Tour. They could have got these players playing, probably not the ones coming from the US. I think that's one of the fundamental issues that people have with this event, that the fact that Dimitrov came over straight from the US and wasn't in isolation at all and just started playing. And it's just a bad look when you consider what else is going on in the world. They could have done it with mandatory masks, with a crowd but socially distanced, with players just from Serbia or who'd been in the country. There were ways of doing it that would have been sort of more suitable, I think.
We've been going an hour and 15 minutes because I don't run a very tight ship. Do we have any other business?
Just a couple of quick notes from listeners on their response to the US Open announcement. Lindsay says, just excited to see meaningful tennis, but it will be a real bummer if it's a weak field. I wish they had considered moving it to a more remote venue. Brenda Parry says, the USA have not got the virus under control yet. I've an uneasy feeling about the US Open going ahead, particularly in New York. Not all players will want to or be able to travel. It won't be a fair playing field, and status as a slam will be undermined, in my opinion. And finally, Sylvia Veroni says, mixed feelings. It'll be great to have tennis on TV and people in the sport getting money, but it won't be a real grand slam this time around.
I mean, I think anybody that doesn't have mixed feelings isn't a proper sports fan. I mean, you ought to have mixed feelings about sport behind closed doors, about sport that isn't accessible to everybody, about sport that, you know, doesn't have a full qualifying or doubles draw. That's right, and those instincts are completely right. But these are completely compromised times, and I think the alternative, but personally, I think the alternative is worse. And yeah, as much as elements of it, you know, fill me with sadness and trepidation, I'm going to pour all my energy into getting excited about the fact that it's happening. And it's tennis, and it probably will be a bit better than we fear it will be.
I think we'll get used to it.
And also try and see it as a stepping stone, because I think I think as Matt expressed a little while ago, I had this big vision of you know, we'll be away and it'll be dreadful. A bit like with sort of the whole situation and lockdown generally. We'll lock down, it'll be awful, however long it has to last. And then magically we'll all emerge and we'll all have this wonderful moment where we see our families again and it's like a fairy tale. Well, in no respects, I think we're all slowly realising, is it going to be like that? It's going to be incremental and stepping stones back to some kind of normality. So if this strange Grand Slam is a stepping stone towards where we all want to be, then personally, I'm here for it.
Me too.
Tennis, guys, tennis. Professional tennis.
No, we've only done 40 tennis podcasts without any tennis.
David's basically gutted that his US Open relived plans are on the back burner.
Only
on the back burner, though.
They're not really, because I have been thinking about that. Anyway,
we've got a lot of thinking to do of how we're going to do US Open dailies on UK time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We'll figure that out.
We'll figure it out, folks. Somehow. David looks worryingly gleeful about that prospect. He's like, my big opportunity to legitimately not sleep. Any other business? Anyone?
No, I don't think so.
No.
I thought we'd done any other business.
No, well, we had, but there was other business, so I felt like I should do one last sweep.
Well, we're going to be back at the weekend with something else. What is it?
I'm steering this ship, David.
Oh yeah, I forgot. Go on, carry on.
However, as I was getting uppity with you, then I realised I actually didn't know what you were saying. So could you help me steer the ship? What are we doing at the weekend?
We're doing Queens Relived. We're doing our own personal Queens Relived.
Great.
So we'll be looking.
Did I know that?
I don't know. Well, we're doing it. We'll be looking back on last year's incredible story with Lopez and Murray and talking to those people and, yeah, having all that. And then it's Wimbledon Relived Dailies.
David leant in as he said that.
Awesome. Yeah.
Can't wait.
Yes. So Queens Relived at the weekend, and then we start with the Wimbledon Relived Dailies a week Monday.
Yeah. Bring it.
Yeah.
Schedule to be announced soon.
Schedule soon to be announced, but I'm going to stitch this up here. I don't think people will be disappointed. It's good, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah. If we mess that up.
Yeah, if we mess up Wimbledon.
I mean, you should have. We had a 2-hour call arguing about what should be in it.
Yeah.
Because we're having to leave
out
matches.
Which concluded with David persuading us to ditch Middle Sunday.
I love Middle Sunday. It's one of my favourite days.
We are always all so on brand. Yeah. It's been a pleasure. Thanks for letting me present this thing, David, and letting it go on for an hour and 21 minutes. Shout out to Patrick, our editor. Thank you very much for sticking with this thing. Shout out to anyone that's still listening after an hour and 21 minutes. I've enjoyed it. It's been a joy to have actual tennis news to talk about for an hour and 21 minutes. So thank you, Matt. Thank you, David. Thank you to all our mascots and Tennis Podcast pets. Thank you for listening. And thank you to everyone that sends us messages. I know we keep saying it, but honestly, they mean so much. They're really keeping us all going. So thank you for that. Thank you for your support. Thank you for listening. We'll be back at the weekend with, apparently, Queens Relived.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.